have Father Larry here from Regina, Saskatchewan. He will be our next speaker. I only had a chance to talk to Father for just a few moments before we came up here. He's in charge of a boys and girls school in Regina that have drug, alcoholic problems, and many other problems that we fight in this world. I am sure you will all listen tentatively because he has a great message for us. Father Larry, please.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you very much. It's indeed a pleasure and an honor for me to be with you today. It's so nice to be with people who are honest, are able to face their problems when some of the rest of us are still grappling with ours and trying to see where we can find enough courage to see ourselves the way we really are. Can you hear me back there? Is it working all right? Oh, great. I'm glad. I'm a little shy asking that. Once when I was speaking in Red Deer, I said, "Can you hear me at the back?" And a fellow stood up and he said, "No, but it doesn't matter." Another fellow stood up in front and turned around and he said, "Well, I can, and I'll trade places with you." These are some of the hazards of speaking. A few Sundays ago when I was preaching in church, I do a little preaching on the side. it's for pocket money and that. One of the babies started to cry. He was just howling, and finally the poor mother was embarrassed, and she got up to leave with the baby. And, well, I didn't want her to do that. I'm accustomed to children. And so I told her, I said, "No, you don't have to leave. The baby's not bothering me." She said, "No, you're bothering him." You have no idea some of the hassles we run into, you know, in speaking. It makes you understand why speakers are so nervous all the time, because you never know what's going to happen. 2 winters ago, I spoke in Edmonton to the teachers at their convention, and they had a gorgeous, lovely teacher that introduced me. She had long blonde hair, ringlets to the middle of her back. You know, they never had teachers like that when I went to school. Or I'd still be there. But anyway, she said all kinds of sweet things about me, and finally I thought it was my turn to speak, so I snuggled up beside her. And, you know, there were two microphones there. There was one like this on a stand, and there was another one on the podium to wrap around your neck. I didn't know that. When I got close to her, she looked at me so sweetly, and she said, "Do you want a neck, Mike?" That's what she said, you know. And, you know, being a farm boy, I found her quite forward. I said, "My name's Larry, but I'll neck with you, you know." Anyway, what can you do? You know, I get into such embarrassing situations. Being a priest doesn't help. It just makes it more embarrassing. Like a year ago, I had to go to Halifax to give a workshop, and I went by Minneapolis, St. Paul, Chicago, Boston. It was an all-expense-paid sort of trip. So I drove from Regina to Minneapolis, St. Paul. When I got to Minneapolis, I was very tired, so I boarded at United Airlines, and I promptly went to sleep. You've heard of United Airlines. They fly the friendly skies. They don't fly the ordinary clouds like Air Canada or PWA. So I was sleeping away. I'm a great, great sleeper. I'm sort of a sleepaholic, you know. I can sleep a lot, and I get hooked on it. These lovely ladies would come along, and they'd say, "Would you buckle up, or would you sit up?" And I'd go back to sleep. "Would you like something to eat or something to drink?" And I'd go back to sleep. And they were sort of enjoying this fat priest that was always sleeping. So by the time we got to Boston, we were fairly well acquainted. So as we were walking out of the plane, this one stood there, and she smiled so professionally and so sweetly, and she said, "Thank you for flying United." And actually, I just woke up, and I wanted to be a bit pleasant, and Without thinking much, I said, "It was a pleasure sleeping with you." You know, I didn't realize how awful that was until a lady just ahead of me, who was obviously a Catholic from Boston, she dropped her briefcase, and then then I knew I had said something wrong. But, but today I promised the committee that I would try to clean up my act, but it's not easy for me. I was born and raised in Saskatchewan, and I was baptized there during the Dirty 30s, and as you know, there wasn't enough water to go around, and I don't think they did a very good job. And anyway, I want to speak to you about family life and about children. I feel a bit embarrassed talking to you people about children because, you know, as a Catholic priest, you aren't even supposed to have any, and so that puts you at a disadvantage. For years and years, I lived in a rectory. For those of you who are not of my faith, I should explain that. A rectory is defined in sociology as a home for unwed fathers. And, you know, in this kind of a setting, you... in this kind of a setting, you don't learn too much about children, but in the last 10 years, I've been working at Bosco Homes in Regina. We have about 45 youngsters. Some are alcoholics, some are drug addicts. We have schizophrenics too, and very depressed, suicidal types. We have all sorts. But I wouldn't want you to think that I'm an expert on family life and on children. Mind you, someone has said that an expert is just an ordinary fellow who's more than 100 miles from home. Now, being from Regina, I think I'd qualify. Someone else has said that expert is a compound word. I think this is a bit more scientific. Expert is a compound word. It's made up of two parts, that word. See, ex and spurt. It's a double sort of a word. Let's look at the first part of the word ex. We'll take this orderly for those of you who were taking notes, so we wouldn't want you to miss anything. So if we look at the first part of the word ex, in English, ex is a bit of a has-been, you know, like an ex-husband, an ex-football player, that sort of thing. In algebra, ex is an unknown quantity. It can be a lot of things, it can be nothing, and I'm told now in the new math it can be less than nothing. I don't know how they do that. But let's go on to the second part of the word, spurt. No, for quite a time, I didn't know the exact definition of a spurt, but if a few months ago, we had a plumber into one of our homes in Regina, and you know, he charged me $38.50. Imagine, $38.50 for just a little fitting under the sink. And he was a Catholic. You could imagine what a Protestant would have charged me. No. And so I try to get everything out of him that I could while he was there. So I asked him if he could give me the definition of a spurt. And he told me, in his opinion as a plumber, that a spurt is nothing else but a drip under pressure. And so, if you understand the word properly, I'll be your expert this afternoon. As long as you realize it's a bit of a has-been, an unknown quantity, and perhaps a wee bit of a drip under pressure. I'll be your expert on family life and on children. But I promised your committee that I would try to say something sensible. While I'm here, I think it's only fair, since you've taken good time to listen to me. I think I have to get a little more serious. I have to apologize to the committee that I don't have a typewritten speech. You know, the usual type, double-spaced with footnotes and all that. I don't have one of those. Actually, I don't do those much anymore. What I do now, I've invented a new system for speech makers. When I speak now, I carry a bit of scratch paper in my pocket, and if I happen to say something intelligent, I make a note of it. And I find that this is quite adequate for my purposes. But I hate to be too gloomy, but I have to tell you that this will be a little bit like school this afternoon. Oh dear. It'll be a little bit like school. My job will be to talk, and your job will be to listen, and well, if you get done before I do, just put up your hands in the usual way. But Anyway, it's really great to be here, and I have to thank you for being brave enough to invite me. It shows a lot of courage. I don't want to be gloomy, but I must tell you that things are not going well in family life in Canada. And as the family goes, of course, so goes society. And let's just have a little look at what's happening in society. In the last 10 years, the murder rate in Canada has more than doubled. So we kill over twice as many people as we did in 1970. We're having a lot of trouble with suicides, especially among the young. Suicide used to be a rather rare occurrence. It's becoming all too common. If we look at the statistics from 1950 to the present day, and if we look at the young, teenagers to 24 years of age, the number of suicides has gone up 386%. Suicide among teenagers used to be number 5 on the hit parade as a cause of death. In the last 3 years, it has moved up to second spot. Now, it is only surpassed by violent accidents like car accidents. And a lot of experts tell us, and these are real experts, that many of these accidents are nothing else but suicide in disguise. And they would maintain that the number one killer of teenagers in the United States and Canada is suicide. I've noticed we're having more child abuse. It's on the upswing. In my province, I know you wouldn't do things like this in Alberta, but in Saskatchewan I saw a little baby that had a fractured skull because mother had beaten it. I saw another baby with broken arms and broken legs. In Chicago, I saw police photographs where a lady took the cigarette lighter from her car and she burned holes in the baby's back. I saw another police photograph where a lady had used the baby as an ashtray. In the United States alone, there are, now it's up to 8, 8 babies that die every day because some mother or dad beats them to death. 8 a day. I've noticed in my work at Bosco Home, I've been working there for some 10 years, and I've noticed that the problems among the young are becoming more serious and they're getting younger. We used to get a lot of pressure to take 16, 17, 18-year-olds. Now we get much more pressure to take 10, 11, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds. We took a 13-year-old from Saskatoon who stabbed a woman to death at 13. We have a 12-year-old boy who took a stick and he helped another boy beat a man to death at 12. We have a 13-year-old who stole a car and he had a sawed-off shotgun. He went west of Saskatoon. He held up a farmer for gas. The farmer was a little slow in giving him the gas, so he shot the farmer. He didn't kill him, but he blew his arm right off. We have a 12-year-old girl who hates herself so much she constantly bangs her head against the wall. We have to watch her constantly. She rips out her hair till she has little bald spots, and she bites herself until her left arm is just raw flesh. We have a 14-year-old who burnt a school to the ground and caused $1 million damage. I could go on and on and on. And we don't even have the world record. The Americans beat us again. In the United States, they have a 6-year-old. Would you believe that? A 6-year-old who poured gasoline on a man who was sleeping and set a match to it. A 6-year-old murderer. When you see this, you've got to understand that we've got some fantastic problem in our society. And we have to look at the family and see what's going on. I used to think as a teacher that we didn't teach the children well. I thought we didn't give them enough morality, ethics, religion, whatever. And surely that's a good part of the problem. I used to also believe we gave them too much violence on television. And that's another bit of the problem. But that's not the whole problem or the big problem. And I learned that the hard way. I took a youngster into our homes who was sniffing a lot of solvents like airplane glue, fingernail polish remover, liquid solder, that sort of stuff. And I thought he didn't know about drugs and about sniffing. I would have to teach him. And then he would change. So I sat him down and I began to teach. I said, now listen, this sniffing you're doing is very bad for your brain. It causes brain damage. It kills brain cells. He said, I know that. No, I said, you don't know that. If you don't stop this sniffing, you'll become mentally retarded. You'll become just like a vegetable. He said, I know that. I couldn't believe it. He knew better, but he still did it. I said, no, you don't know that. If you don't stop this sniffing, you're going to die. And he looked at me with beautiful blue eyes, 15 years old, and he said, I don't care. He didn't care. This was several years ago, but 2 weeks after I talked to him on Easter Sunday, he proved it to me. It was a half an hour after supper. He had smuggled a high-powered rifle into the house with mushroom shells, and he blew his head off. It took us a week to clean that room, and I learned a heavy, heavy lesson that day. He didn't care, and he wasn't kidding. I worked with another little girl. She was only 13. She was into a lot of drugs at 13. She had even dabbled in heroin. She was so promiscuous, she would stand on our main drag in Regina. She would flag down cars, and she would beg men to sleep with her for free. She had venereal disease so bad the doctors were worried about her life. So they gave her to us. They asked us to keep her off the street and give her her medication. And we did that. But she didn't get any better. So finally we watched her around the clock, and our nurse discovered that she took the medication that was meant for her vagina, and she flushed it down the toilet. Again, I thought, this girl doesn't know about venereal disease. We've got to teach her. So we sat her down, the nurse and I, and began to teach. I said, listen, you know, this VD you have is the real stuff. It can make you blind. It can make you insane. She said, I know that. I said, no, you don't know that. If you don't take your medication, you're going to die. And she looked at me in that same old way, and she said, I don't care. She didn't care. We weren't able to reach her. She ran away. Somehow she took medication from someone because she survived. I saw her on the street again about a month ago. She's still into a lot of drugs and cheap prostitution. She's dying in slow stages. She looks like an old nervous wreck. At 23. She just doesn't care. And finally, it has dawned on me that a whole lot of our youngsters today don't care because no one has ever cared for them. No one ever loved them. There wasn't enough love in the family. See, it has to happen like this. It has to happen in three steps. Somebody has to love me for a long, long time. Then I get to love myself, then I acquire the ability to love others. It's always in those three steps. Somebody loves me, I get to love me, then I get to love you. That's how it should be. But for a lot of youngsters, it doesn't happen. They don't get that loving, caring environment, and so they just don't care about themselves and what happens to them. So they don't care how they drive. Have you ever noticed how our young people drive? One of our boys stole our van. At least he kept it in the family. But he drove it around the city at 85, 90 miles an hour. He went over sidewalks, curbs. He twisted the frame, ripped out the shock absorbers. He did some $1,500 worth of damage. Finally, the police caught him. He was hung up on a big curb. And he was angry because he wanted to die. They don't care what drugs they take. My youngsters will take drugs from a stranger in the dark. One of our girls took a glass of wine laced with LSD and a bunch of other junk. She didn't know what was in it. She didn't care. She spent 3 days in intensive care, hanging between life and death. Thank God she made it. A lot of them don't. They don't even care if they get pregnant. In fact, some of my girls will tell me they wish they would get pregnant. Then somehow they feel they would have a friend, someone who would cherish them and love them. A whole lot of mine don't care if they pass or fail, because a whole lot of them don't care if they live or die. They just don't care. We've got a fantastic problem in our society. You know, politicians worry about unemployment, inflation. Sure, these are problems. They worry about the energy crisis. That's serious.
But the big, big crisis today is the love crisis. We haven't got enough love to go around. So we're desperately short of mums and dads who can really love. We're short of ministers, priests, social workers who can give of themselves. We're short of teachers, all sorts of adults who can really love and who are willing to lay down their life for their friend. So we're short of love. And the youngsters and the elderly and a whole lot of people are starting to feel the pinch. Just like you can't grow a plant without water and sunshine, you can't grow people without love and caring. It just doesn't work that way. I'll show you what happens. You be my parents for a while, okay? Come on, be good sports. You know when you have kids, you have to take the good with the bad. So you be my parents, and I'll be your child. Now, as a little one, I don't know who I am. I don't know if I'm a good boy or if I'm a bad boy. I don't know. I look at you, my parents, my teachers. You're my mirror. You see, you're the mirror, and you tell me who I am. I look into your face, and especially into your eyes, and if I see love there, I get the feeling that I'm lovable. And if I see trust in your face, I conclude that I'm trustworthy, so I don't lie, cheat, or steal. And if you think of me as being a precious little fellow, I begin to feel that I'm a good little lad. That's what psychologists call a good self-image. Then I can get close to people. I can get involved in deep, loving relationships. I can make a marriage click. I can relate with my own children. I'll find my religion easier to practice. I'll find it easier to pray. That's the way it should be. But that's not what's happening. In our busy, materialistic, technological society, you know, we've made a nice world for machines, but it's not very good for people. More often than not, I look into my parents' eyes, my teacher's eyes, there's no love there. So I get the feeling that I'm not lovable. I look into your face and there's no trust there. So I conclude that I'm not trustworthy. So it's all right for me to lie, cheat, and steal. I act out a bit to get attention. And then you label me as being a rotten little delinquent. And I begin to see myself as a dirty little kid. I go to school, I'm so mixed up, I can't pay attention. I can't concentrate. I get way behind in my classes. My classmates laugh at me, they call me stupid. And before long I have report cards to prove it. So eventually I see myself as ugly, rotten, dirty, stupid, and bad. That's what psychologists call a bad self-image. I feel so ugly, rotten, dirty, stupid, and bad. I feel so yucky, as the kids call it. I can't be close to you. Oh, no, it's worse than being naked in front of you. Mind you, that's more popular than it used to be. But still, some of us have hang-ups about it, you know. And so I have to cover my ugliness with something. I cover it generally with a mask. With many of my youngsters, it's the tough guy mask. I feel so scared and rotten, so insecure inside. I wear a tough guy mask. I'm tough, don't you see? I chew nails and spit tacks. I can beat up more little kids. I can pop more pills, drink more booze. I can make more girls pregnant. I can drive faster. I'm tough, don't you see? Or it's the nice guy mask. I smile at everyone. I always say the appropriate thing. This is more becoming in my profession, of course. Well, yes, it helps the collection. Don't knock it. We have to live too, okay? It doesn't matter a whole lot whether it's the tough guy mask or the nice guy mask. There are hundreds of other masks. What is really sad is that I have to wear a mask. The mask becomes a barrier between you and me. It's always between us. As a human being, I want to find my happiness in loving and in being loved. That's the key to human happiness, by the way. You know, theologians of all denominations have told us for years that we would find our happiness in loving our God and loving our neighbor, and being loved by our God and by our neighbor. We thought they were kidding. We didn't get that excited about it. Now, at long last, Even psychologists and psychiatrists are discovering that this is indeed the case. Dr. William Glasser of California, the famous author of Reality Therapy, Glasser tells us over and over again that happiness is found in loving and in being loved. That's the key to it. So happiness is not found in possessing material goods. When I'm in Alberta, I repeat the statement. I say, happiness is not found in possessing material goods. In Saskatchewan, I just have to say it once. It suffices. But happiness is found in loving and in being loved. But look at what happens to me if I live behind a mask. I would like to love and to be loved, but the mask is in the road. It's always between us. I'm like Humpty Dumpty who fell behind the wall. Sometimes I try to put the mask aside. I try to get close to you and let you get close to me. And for a little while it feels good. But as you get closer, you threaten me. I'm afraid you're going to discover me. You're going to find out that I'm ugly, rotten, dirty, stupid, and bad, and you're going to drop me. So I keep moving away. And if you keep insisting on being my friend, I'll turn against you. You're getting too close. I'll purposely insult you. I'll say, drop dead, get out of my life. Now, I've worked with 300 of the sickest and the toughest on the prairies. You know, some are called murderers, arsonists, drug addicts, schizophrenics, suicidal, depressed types. They have all kinds of different psychiatric labels. But they have one thing in common. They hate themselves. They're convinced that they're ugly, rotten, dirty, stupid, and bad. I could tell you about many of them. I'm thinking of one of our girls in particular. She's always crying in her bedroom. She cries there because she's lonesome, of course. She's so lonesome. So we ask her to come out. We entice her. We say, come on out and meet the other youngsters. They'll like you. She comes out and sits down at the table to have a little coffee with them, and she puts on the phoniest Avon sort of smile. I'm sorry, ladies. Avon's a good product. It's just a smile that I'm knocking. My apologies. We say, don't smile like that. Just be yourself. Be real. She tries it, and the youngsters get to like her. In fact, they move closer to her. For a few days, she looks happier, more peaceful. But as they move still closer, she feels threatened. She's afraid of being discovered. Her anxiety levels go up. She actually shakes when she takes a cup of coffee. And then she begins to withdraw. They ask her to go for a Coke. No, she has to do a bit of homework. They want to take her to a movie. No, she has to take a bath and do her hair. And some of them insist on being her friend. Then she purposely drives them away. She insults them. She says, drop dead. Get out of my life. I hate you. I'm a loner and I like it. And a bunch of other four-letter words that priests don't understand. But, of course, in my work, I'm becoming fairly bilingual, and I can pick it up. But I can even contribute on occasion, but we won't go into that. We're short of time. But this little one will never be happy unless and until someone loves her long enough that she begins to love herself. And therefore, I urge you in your family to teach your children that they're beautiful, precious, and lovable. Teach them that you're so happy they're there. And do the same with each other and with the elderly, because there is no human growth without that. There is no human growth outside of a loving relationship. And if you give them this good self-image, then they have a chance to be happy as human beings. And they'll get rid of the lonesome feeling, of course. Today we have so many lonesome people. We've never had so many. In fact, I don't think of this as the atomic age or the jet age, perhaps in a technological way, but in a very human way. This is the lonesome age. We've never had so many lonesome people. This is the heyday for pornography. What is pornography? Psychologically speaking, pornography is a substitute for a deep loving relationship. Here we have a lonesome person who can't take closeness, so he looks at pictures to try to get rid of that lonesome feeling. This is the great day for drinking alone because we're lonesome. This is the heyday for the CB radio. Now, I'm not knocking the CB. It's a wonderful gadget. The truckers use it on the highway. They chit-chat back and forth. They find out where the Queen's Cowboys are located. It's wonderful. In In Saskatchewan, the farmers are using the CB to wonderful advantage. They put a CB in the house, another one in the tractor, and they chit-chat back and forth between the tractor and the house. It's fantastic. Some of the farmers are discovering their wife after 42 years. So I'm not knocking the CB. But in the cities, I find people are getting CB radios because they're lonesome. They're so lonesome. And they chit-chat with strangers in a superficial way. 10-4, good buddy, to try to get rid of the lonesome feeling. My youngsters are a good example of that, or bad, if you wish. They insisted that we had to get a CB radio, or we would have had a riot. We thought it was cheaper to get the radio than hold the riot. So we got this little radio and we put it in our big blue van. They loved it so much they would actually fight over it. They would rip out the microphone and hit each other with it. So we had to give them 5 minutes each, you see. Johnny, you're on. Now, Susan, it's your turn. This one day I was driving from Estevan in southeastern Saskatchewan back towards Regina. I had 15 of them in the van with me. And all of a sudden, they got someone on the CB. What excitement! You know, it was better than catching a big fish. They all rushed to the front and nearly upset the crazy van. I had to get them to sit down. Now, any fool can drive a van, but you try to keep time for those kids. You know, you need a lawyer. Anyway, they found out the good buddy was going through Weyburn, and we were going through there, too. He asked us where we were going. My lad said, oh, we're going to A&W, because there's no McDonald's there. They prefer McDonald's. He was going to A&W as well. And when we were getting into A&W, he was so close he could actually see us. He had caught up to us. And I heard him say over the radio, oh, it must be you folks in the big blue van. You know how these people talk. And my lad said, 10-4, good buddy, that's us in the big blue van. And he pulled in right beside us in the next stall. And my kids would have nothing to do with him. See, he was too close. I was so embarrassed, I literally shoved two of them out. I said, get the hell out and talk to him, you know. So they'd been talking to him for half an hour. So the two that I shoved out, they went out and they said, hi, hi, and they rushed back in the van, you see. Now, these are the signs of our times. They're so, so lonesome, but they can't take closeness. So we have to teach our children, and we have to teach each other at AA. Always teach people that they're beautiful, precious, and lovable, that we're so happy they're there. And then they can handle closeness. They can get involved in deep, loving relationships, and the lonesome feeling goes away. Another thing that it does, of course, with children, if you're interested in that, is that it changes behavior. Now, there's all sorts of tricks to change behavior with children, but when you want to change the behavior in a very lasting way, you must change the self-image. In other words, if you teach me that I'm a good little boy, I tend to act like one. But if you teach me that I'm a rotten little delinquent, I'll live up to your expectations. I won't disappoint you. It's something like in drama. Possibly some of you have taken drama at university or in evening classes. If you have, of course, you call it drama. But it's the same stuff. In northern Saskatchewan, where I was raised, we didn't know any better. We called it putting on plays. But it's the same stuff. So we'll imagine we're putting on a play, or as they say in the city, we're going to stage a production. And you're going to be the director because you took drama, I can't even say it well, and you asked me to play the part of Lincoln. Now, being from northern Saskatchewan, from the bush, I'm somewhat uncultured and boorish. And so as Lincoln, I ham it up quite a bit. I try to make it exciting for the audience. So as Lincoln, I slouch around, I put my hands in my pockets, I pick my nose, I do a variety of things to make it exciting for the audience. And as the director, you can't take it. You say, no, 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 Larry, cut it, cut it, cut it. You know how these people are dramatic. Take it from the top. Remember, Larry, Lincoln was a great man. He freed the slaves. He changed the course of American history. Come on, Larry, walk tall. Walk tall like American presidents used to before Nixon. You can do it, kid. Oh, dear, I shouldn't have said that. But you never know where the CIA are nowadays. Anyway, you're close to the border here, too. Oh, dear. Anyway, I get the message. I have to see myself as a great man. I freed the slaves. I changed the course of American history. And when I begin to see myself as a great man, I begin to act like a great man. I stand a little taller. My voice becomes a little more solemn. And as the director, you say, you've got it. That's it. You're in character. It's beautiful. Now, if this only happened in drama, it wouldn't be so important. But this is how it is in real life. So if you teach me that I'm a good little boy, I act like one, and if you teach me that I'm a rotten little delinquent, I live up to your expectations. It's as simple as that. Let's imagine for a moment that you would be my foster parents, okay? And I would be a little tiny foster child. Now, this will take a lot of imagination because I'm so large, but try to go along with it. Imagine that I'm a little foster child, and this good social worker brings me to your home and asks you if you would take me in. And you're a bit leery about it, and no, the worker doesn't help much. She says, "You better be careful, he's from the bush. There could be trouble, you know." So it makes you a bit nervous, and I notice that the social worker leaves a large brown envelope with my social history and my cumulative record and a lot of things that aren't very flattering about me. And in a few days, you have to take me down to the school to meet my teacher. And, oh, that makes me quite nervous. I notice you have the big brown envelope along. And I see that you and the teacher go into what I think is the broom closet, and you have a little talk about me. And I get up to the keyhole, and I listen, I try to get everything I can. And one of you says, "Look at this. He was raised without a father. He was born. In a few weeks, his father died." Ooh, it could have been shock. It's scary, you know. And another one says, I think it was you. You say, "Look at this. In grade 4, he bit the teacher." And there's a footnote which says, "In the stomach." You know, it's the footnotes that give all the gory details. Well, I had to do it. She was going to strap me. But now you and the teacher agree that you've got a tough kid on your hands. And you both agree that you'll have to put me right in the front of the class because the teacher might have to reach me to manage the situation, you see. And if this is a Catholic school, she may have to say, "God is love and don't you forget it." How do you think I got my education? And you know, I feel very good at the head of the class. I've always been in front because I've always been troublesome. So the class hardly gets underway. I throw around a few little spitballs to feel out the situation. And with my compass, I take the odd wee little blood samples from my classmates. Well, I'm interested in biology and that sort of thing. Just to see how the teacher will react to me. Will the teacher turn on me and say, "You dirty little delinquent. Ah, I know what you did to the teacher in grade 4. You won't get away with that in my class." That makes me feel good. I can cope with that, you understand, because adults have always been upset with me. So I feel right at home. I feel so good that my reputation has gone before me. And even here in Alberta, you recognize my potential as a gangster, and you're treating me accordingly. You know what would really throw me for a loop as a youngster? If you would refuse to believe that I'm a bad boy. If you could make a wild act of faith that when God made this little critter, he didn't blow it or he didn't have a bad day, that somehow, somewhere, there has to be some place in the universe for this little guy. If you could do that. Now, this isn't easy. You know, this surpasses religion. Oh, it's easy to believe in God. He's all perfect and all beautiful. But you try to believe in this little critter from the bush. Ah, that takes faith. So if you could sit down with me after school or after supper and say, "Larry, what happened in school today? You know, you're such a good little boy, but the spitballs and the blood samples, it's so out of character. Oh, this really shocks me. What's going on here? You're a certified foster parent, you're approved by social services, and you don't even understand that I'm bad? I'm bad, 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 don't you see? My God, you're a slow learner. You don't seem to catch on. So this very night, I'll do something worse." I'll do something worse. You'll get the message. I'll do something worse. And then what will you do after I do something worse? Will you haul me off to some psychiatrist? He won't cure me, but he'll drug me enough to slow me down. Or will you pack me in ice and ship me to Bosco Home in Regina for treatment? Or will you have the good courage to sit down with me again and say, "Larry, what happened last night? You know, you're such a good boy. We've had bad boys here before. We had one from British Columbia. But you're such a good boy. It's written all over your face, but gee, gosh, you know, burning the school buses pretty far out, you know. If you keep on reflecting back to me that I'm good, that I'm precious, that I'm beautiful, I'll stand on my toes, I'll reach, I'll struggle and strive, and I'll live up to your expectations, or I'll run away. Out of the 300 that I've worked with and lived with in the past 10 years, I'll tell you a little secret. We never kicked one out. We never had to. As a staff, all we try to do is reflect back to them that they're good, they're precious, they're beautiful. They stand on their toes, and do they change? Oh, yes, we get 15 or 20% that run away, especially in the first month or so. They find it too scary to get close, and they take off. Some we get back, some we don't. But the vast majority, a good 80 to 85% of them, hang in there, and do they grow, and how they change. You wouldn't believe it. One of our old boys, now you must understand, all our kids were write-offs. We only accept kids that have failed in every other institution. Our kids have gone through 15, 17 foster homes, they've been through psychiatric wards, all kinds of treatment centers. We only take the ones that nobody else wants. They've given up. We accept them. And still we're able to help 80 to 85% of them. Imagine. One of our old boys is graduating in law. We've always needed a lawyer. One of our girls is graduating in psychology. One of our other girls went to the University of Calgary and got a degree in journalism. And now she's at the University of West Berlin and she's taking a second degree in journalism in German. And she's a sweet little English girl from Calgary. Isn't that something? One of our old boys started to work in Zeller's store in Regina. He moved little boxes around in the back room. Then he was promoted and transferred. And now he's the general manager of Zeller's store in Thunder Bay, Ontario. If you ever threw their drop in, mention my name, he'll give you 10% off. If I tell you what he used to do, he'll give you 50% off. You know? And then we've had quite a number who've been lucky enough to become plumbers and electricians and things that pay, you know. So what I'm suggesting, if we can do it with very difficult youngsters, you must do it with your own and with each other at home and with each other in AA. You must, at all costs, teach the people around you that they're precious, beautiful, and lovable. And then you give them a chance to change and you give them a chance to grow. The University of Saskatchewan has discovered that you can't grow wheat on cement. They've researched the whole thing, and they've proven it beyond a shadow of a doubt. Now, the farmers had some suspicion to that effect for some time, but now it has been fully researched, and we all realize that it's true. What we should do once and for all is to prove that you can't grow kids on cement. They don't grow well in back alleys. They don't grow at all downtown. Children only grow in the loving environment called a home. The home is the good soil where children grow. And we, the parents, we are their water and their sunshine. And just like when you want to grow a plant, you don't keep it in a closet. No, you have to bring it out and put it on the windowsill and give it water and sunshine, and you have to wait for it to grow. You know, we get so impatient with each other when we don't grow fast enough. And we get so upset with our children, we'd like to choke them or beat them because they're not growing fast enough. You know, children are like plants. Did you ever notice with your house plants when they don't grow fast enough, it doesn't help much if you pull on them? No, you give them water and sunshine, and you have to wait for them to grow. We need homes. Politicians worry about the housing shortage, and surely that's serious. But the big problem today is the home shortage. We're really short of homes. You know, we have companies in our province like Boychuk Homes, Cairns Homes, Nelson Homes. There's a whole lot of them. I'm sure you have the same here. Now, these people advertise that they sell homes. Actually, they should be sued for false advertising. You can't buy a home. You have to buy a house, but you make the home. And you make the home with the love and sacrifice that you put into it. To make a home, you need a mother who can love and give of herself. You need a dad who can be warm, loving, affectionate, and give of himself. And he has to be able to spend time with his family, with his children. You need teenagers who can sacrifice a bit of their own way and obey even when it's hard. And they have to put their bit of love into the bank. And when you get the love of mother, the love of dad, the love of the teenagers, and you put it all together, you create the beautiful environment called a home. That's where people grow to be healthy and happy, and they do well. But when mother is selfish, dad is selfish, the teenagers are selfish, when everyone's out...